The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's dance. It's good for your body, soul, and even your brain. This is the health section of the Reader's Digest. Wearing all black and sitting in a tufted white ottoman in her sunlit living room, Sarah Robichaud is teaching a routine inspired by modern ballet to 80 students on Zoom. The Bolshoi-trained dancer spreads her arms wide in exaggerated movements to a slow cover of the Proclaimers, "I'm Gonna Be 500 Miles," as her students get in the groove. "We're just going to start with a gentle, gentle sway back and forth," Robichaud says to the group. "I want you to think there's a thread attached to your wrist, to someone pulling that thread from side to side." Many of her students are seated as well. More than half of them have Parkinson's disease, and typically movement can be difficult. But when they try to mirror her fluid and graceful movements, a look of ease comes over them. Growing evidence shows that dancing can boost brain health and help manage symptoms of neurocognitive and movement disorders, including Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, MS, Alzheimer's, dementia, and brain injury. And I'm going to do a little aside here. The American Dance Festival in Durham, North Carolina, has an actual session, special session for people with Parkinson's, and it's a very slow movement dance thing. It's really a great thing. For example, a 2021 York University study showed that weekly dance training improved motor function and daily living for those with mild to moderate Parkinson's. This piggybacks on other findings that show how activities that target balance, coordination, flexibility, creativity, and memory work can improve Parkinson's symptoms. Robichaud started dancing with Parkinson's in 2007 as a way to give back to her community. A few years later, her grandfather was diagnosed with the disease. Robichaud was able to dance with him in his long-term care home until his final days. "The compassion and care that I have for our dancers is that they're all my grandfather," she says. Recently, one of her students, a man in his 50s who had been adamant that dancing wasn't for him, said that he now has more dexterity in his hands and generally moves more freely. "I can't deny how this is changing my life," he told her. So what is it about dance that differs from brisk walk or other aerobic exercises? Dance is medicine. Helena Blumen, a cognitive scientist at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City, says the intricate intricate mental multitasking that dance requires engages various parts of the brain at the same time, which can lead to strengthening of neural connections across different regions. Basically, dancing requires more brain power than simple repetitive exercises. "It is socially demanding, cognitively demanding, and physically demanding," she says. Anyone who's ever felt the irresistible urge to sway to a favorite song knows that combining music and movement can lift your mood and melt away stress. But there's a lot more happening in your brain when you're trying to follow even the easiest choreography. In dance, we have to learn patterns. We have to think symmetrically. And as asymmetrically, we have to remember sequences, as David Leventhal, program director at Mark Morris Dance for PD program, where Robichaud trained. The effect extends beyond dance class to the real world. Tasks like navigating the kitchen or walking to the bus stop can become more attainable if they are regarded as choreography. While scientists are still learning how the mechanisms of dancing work in the brain, a clearer picture is beginning to emerge. In 2018, researchers at Otto von Guericke University in Magdeburg, Germany, did MRI scans of older adults who had participated in one or two programs over a six-month period. One group practiced dance and the other did a traditional exercise program with cycling and strength training. While both groups improved their level of physical fitness, the dancers grew more white and gray matter in the parts of the brain responsible for cognitive processes, such as working memory, attention, and high-level thinking. Both white and gray matter typically decline as we get older, making communication in the brain lag and certain cognitive tasks, such as multitasking and problem-solving, tougher. Together, the researchers hypothesize that these brain changes contribute more to more neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to form new connections and pathways. Imagine your brain is like a city with loads of roads and pathways. Brain plasticity is akin to the city's ability to build new roads, repair old ones, and even change the direction of traffic based on how often the routes are used and what the city needs. So, just as cities adapt and change over time to meet the needs of their residents, our brains can reshape and adjust based on our experiences and learning. What's more, the dance group showed an increase in blood plasma, BDNF, a protein that plays a crucial role in developing brain plasticity. In a 2022 study, Blumen and other researchers from Albert Einstein College of Medicine found that social ballroom dancing was associated with reduced atrophy in the hippocampus, a brain region that is key to memory functioning and is particularly affected by Alzheimer's disease. The dancers were compared with other adults over age 65 who walked on a treadmill. In other words, the dancers' memory center isn't shrinking as quickly, improving their overall quality of life and potentially reducing the risk of dementia. Similar studies have shown the benefits of dance for people with conditions ranging from MS and Huntington's disease to autism and depression. Dance therapy might even help people with brain injuries. A Finnish study of people with severe traumatic brain injury showed that dance-based rehabilitation might improve mobility and cognitive and overall well-being. Dance is a body acceptance. In addition to the physical and neurological benefits, dance can also help people accept what their bodies can or can't do, making it easier to live with diseases they have. Dance is about befriending the body, says Erika Hornthal, a Chicago-based dance and movement therapist and author of Body Aware, Rediscover Your Mind-Body Connection, Stop Feeling Stuck, and Improve Your Mental Health with Simple Movement Practices. Boy, that's a long title. Rather than trying to control or fix our bodies, dance helps us meet ourselves where we are, she says. Donia Baines, 44, was diagnosed with MS in 2006 after her body went numb from the chest down. Today her hands are still numb, and she suffers from severe muscle tightness and balance issues when making standing and walking difficult. She recently joined an online dance program for people with MS offered by the University of Florida. Not only has it improved her coordination and range of motion, it has also helped her overcome her fear of being judged for how she moves in the class and out in the world. I see other people moving like I'm moving, she says, and know that I don't have to be a professional and super technical in my dancing or make sure my leg lifts this way. It made me comfortable with where I am right now. Dancing as community. Dancing with others make people feel less different, and it helps combat the loneliness and isolation of living with a chronic illness. Allowing those broader connections is one of the reasons that programs initially intended only for people with Parkinson's and MS have opened up to everyone. For many people, Leventhal says, dance has become vital to their quality of life. They've come to rely on it in a way that is an essential part of their Parkinson's management. It's not an extra thing that they do because they like to do it, he says. Since he started teaching more than 22 years ago, the Dance for PD model has been adopted by 300 communities in 28 countries around the world. Some, including India and South Korea, have incorporated their own cultural dance styles into the class model. Still, researchers say they're only scratching the surface of understanding how dance can be used therapeutically. Larger studies are needed to confirm the findings of the smaller trials that have been done so far. Additional studies are also needed to pinpoint the most effective types of dance movements and the optimal length and frequency of the classes. It's also unclear who, in terms of age or disease progression, would benefit most. Those who aren't drawn to dance might want to try doing other brain-stimulating physical activities, such as Tai Chi or yoga, says Notker Mueller, a health scientist professor at the University of Potsdam, who co-authored a study at Otto von Guericke University. And for people who are timid about dancing in front of others, online classes make it easy to dance at home, like no one is watching. Many Zoom participants leave their cameras off. Robichaud's mission is to create a sense of community, so much so that she sometimes takes her Dancing with Parkinson's program on the road and teaches the class from dancers' homes. Wherever she teaches, her message is one of hope. We want you to feel joyful, to get more involved in your community, to explore the limitless possibility for the rest of your life, she says. not your average Joe. The German everyman is named Otto Norman Wilbacher, which translates as Otto Normal Consumer. In France, he's called Monsieur Tout le Monde, or Mr. Everybody. And in Finland, he's known as Matt Melikatatani, meaning Matthew, one of us. Hero Pets. Kit the Courageous. Canine. Officer Bill Cushing needed a partner. His dog needed a purpose. Together, they rescued each other. And there's a picture of the dog and the policeman. He looks like about, he's probably in his 30s, thereabouts. Bill Cushing was exercising in his home gym when he got the call. It was a little before 1 p.m. on June 4, 2021, and the Braintree, Massachusetts police officer thought he could get a workout before his shift started. When Cushing suddenly heard his sirens, though, and his phone lit up with the Baltimore Police Department number, he knew his day was about to start early. A domestic violence call had come in, and the department needed Cushing and Kit, his police dog for the past decade, to help find the suspect. Cushing rushed to put on his uniform. Kit, an 11-year-old German Shepherd Belgian Malinois mix, snapped to attention. It was time to go to work. Cushing drove toward the scene on McCusker Drive, listening to the radio chatter and speeding up as he heard the accident escalate. The suspect possibly had two firearms, was on foot, and had fled into the woods behind a massive apartment complex. Cushing knew the spot. Those woods had been the site of many police incidents when he and Kit had tracked down assailants in the past. By the time Cushing whipped into the parking lot at the edge of the woods, other officers were already there. One directed Cushing and Kit to the last known spot where the fugitive had been seen. Kit immediately picked up the scent, and they were off, charging into the brush. Kit tugged forcibly at his leash, almost dragging Cushing into a sprint. Soon Kit leaped behind a large rock, which let Cushing know that behind it the armed man was after was hiding and ready to pounce. 10 years early, on a warm July day in 2011, Cushing climbed into a van with Mark O'Reilly, the master canine trainer from the Massachusetts Department of Correction. They headed toward a police dog training center in Bethany, Connecticut. Cushing didn't yet know much about being a canine officer. He'd been a beat cop for the past 6 years. But now, in his early 30s, he wanted more action to make greater contribution to keeping his hometown safe. He believed that becoming a canine officer was the way to do it. Not every cop can become a canine officer. Candidates need to be hardworking, incredibly fit, and most of all, catch the attention of the police chief. Once officers are selected, they must undergo hundreds of hours of specialized training before getting to work with a dog. That's a very elite circle. At the training facility, Cushing and O'Reilly emerged from their vehicle to a chorus of dog barks inside the long white building. One of the facility's trainers came out with a dog for their inspection. His name was Kit. Kit was a mangy-looking mutt with matted hair, big pointy ears that stood straight up, and a funny look in his eye. Cushing didn't like what he saw. O'Reilly, though, wasn't paying attention to Kit's looks, but to the way he strode out of his kennel as though he belonged. He was just 11 months old and hadn't been trained to track scents. Yet he immediately spotted a 5-gallon bucket with some toys in it. He attacked the bucket with a vengeance, stopping it over and thrashing it around. "We'll take him," O'Reilly said. "Ah, jeez," Cushing thought. Now this funny-looking dog with no tracking experience was coming home with him. The next 16 weeks served as a boot camp for Cushing and Kit. Each morning, the pair headed out for intensive 8- to 12-hour training sessions, tracking through vast fields, empty buildings, and surrounding forests. O'Reilly told Cushing that he had to learn to trust his dog, even when Cushing had his doubts. Still, the most important part of the training took place at home. Cushing learned that for their partnership to be successful, Kit needed to believe that Cushing was the only person who provided him with food and water, and that his own survival depended on Cushing's safety. So for the first few weeks, Cushing fed Kit only by hand and would serve him a water bowl, and if Kit didn't drink, he would remove it. Cushing became everything to Kit. It was mutual. Cushing didn't have a wife, girlfriend, or children. Kit was the focus of his profession, his home life, and his affection. But halfway through their training, Cushing and Kit went to the prison complex for a long, challenging tracking test. A trainer, posing as a suspect clad in protective bite suit, hid hundreds of yards away. Kit picked up his scent and aggressively pursued. When he spotted the trainer, Kit leaped at him, flying 10 feet through the air and nearly knocking him down to the ground. Whoa, Cushing thought. This dog actually works. Congratulations, O'Reilly told Cushing. You are cleared hot, which meant that Kit was ready to hit the streets. And there's a picture here of Kit and the policeman during their training, and also them walking down a railroad track, obviously trailing something. Kit and Cushing's first assignment was to track a bank robber. Kit picked up a scent at the bank and led Cushing down the road where they discovered some cash that the robber had dumped before fleeing in a getaway car. Kit's discovery helped the other officers pick up the trail and capture the robber. Many successful assignments followed. Sometimes, when the tracks were long and grueling, Cushing wondered if Kit was still on the scent. If Kit was still on the scent. Then he would hear O'Reilly's voice in his head, "Trust your dog. Trust your dog." So Cushing did, and Kit never let him down. Cushing soon grew to rely on Kit in other ways, too. If Cushing had a personal problem, he'd talk to Kit about it. If Cushing was having a rough day, Kit would intuitively rest his head on him. Before Cushing knew it, Kit wasn't just his partner. They were best friends. In the early hours of a March day in 2016, Cushing was asleep when his phone rang. It was his lieutenant. A man had allegedly threatened the mother of his two children and was on the loose, drunk and carrying a knife. "We need you and Kit to find this guy," the lieutenant ordered. Kit was already up and standing at attention. He seemed to sense that they were going to work. Kit barked as they drove through with sirens screaming and lights flashing toward the neighborhood where the suspect had last been seen. When they arrived, Kit picked up the scent of his target, 44-year-old Robert Dusson. Kit then led Cushing and other officers to several backyards onto a street where Kit stopped and attempted to dive under a parked car. The officers then knew that where the man was they were after was hiding. Cushing gripped Chitsley's under his left hand, shining his flashlight underneath the vehicle to see the fugitive. The round beam of light passed over Dusarve's face. "Come out, man," Cushing said. Silence. "Hey, buddy, I don't want my dog to bite you. Just come out and give up." Kit sat still, riveted, waiting for Cushing's command to pounce. Then Dusarve poked his head up from under the car and looked directly at him. Dusarve allegedly said, "I'm going to kill you." An instant later, the suspect darted out from under the car, pulled a large kitchen knife out of his pants, and advanced towards Cushing and Kit. "Drop the knife," Cushing recalls, "or my dog's going to bite you." Dusarve kept moving toward them, leaving Cushing no choice. He released his grip on the leash. Kit leaped through the air and sank his teeth into the subject's right hip. Dusarve wailed and began flailing his knife. Cushing was terrified that it would stab Kit. Enraged, Dusarve advanced, stabbing at the air just inches from Cushing. Cushing sensed he would shoot or be killed in the situation, but he feared he might strike Kit while trying to hit the suspect. He fired two quick rounds and Dusarve fell to the ground, with Kit still biting him. Cushing rolled over and grabbed Kit around the neck to release his bite. Other officers immediately attempted CPR on Dusarve, but it was too late. Dusarve later died at the hospital. Wanting to make sure that Dusarve hadn't stabbed Kit, Cushing inspected the dog bodies for injury. When he found none, he bear-hugged Kit, burying his face in his fur. "Good boy, Kit," he said. "We're good. We're good." Just a month after the shooting, Cushing and Kit found themselves in the same neighborhood, tracking another domestic violence suspect. Boy, you wouldn't want to be married in that neighborhood. Cushing was on high alert. His breathing was heavy and his heart pounded. When Cushing stepped on a tree branch and it snapped, he drew his weapon. Another officer turned to look at him after Cushing was okay. Cushing had assured the chief that he was ready to return to work, but now, back in the field, drawing his gun at imaginary bad guys, it was obvious to Cushing that he wasn't okay at all. Over and over again, he replayed in his head what had happened the night he'd killed Dusarve. He was sure that he had done everything right, but he couldn't stop thinking about Dusarve's children, who had lost their father. Cushing knew he needed help. He began going to a therapist. He also consulted Kit's veterinarian, who said that Cushing's emotions were traveling right down the leash into Kit. Cushing knew he had to work hard to heal, not just for his own sake, but also for Kit's. After several weeks of therapy, they went back to work and continued to excel. Then in 2018, Cushing started dating a woman. She moved in with Cushing and Kit, and in June 9, 2019, their daughter was born. Cushing worried that Kit might react poorly to a baby in the house, in their house. After all, Kit was so protective of Cushing in their territory. But just as Kit had seemed to feel Cushing's fear and trauma, Kit seemed to also feel his love. Kit played with the baby. She fell asleep resting on him. He wouldn't let anyone other than Cushing and his girlfriend near her. As for Cushing, he took her parenting like a natural. After all, Kit had been taught him how to care for another being, how to nurture, and how to put someone else's needs before his own. As parenting became a priority, Cushing began to work less. In 2020, Cushing and his girlfriend welcomed their second daughter. That meant turning down even more assignments. Soon after the call from McCusker Drive came in on June 24, 2021, Kit yanked Cushing through the thorny woods and two other officers, Richard Siebert and Matthew Donahue, following. They were chasing 34-year-old Andrew Homan after a woman had called the police saying he had tried to choke her and put a gun to her head before fleeing. Cushing could tell by the purpose with which Kit was pulling him that Homan was hiding somewhere nearby. Suddenly Kit stopped, jumped up and down near a 4-foot-tall rock. Kit was telling him Homan was behind it. "Show me your hands," Cushing shouted. "Show me your hands." Homan emerged with his gun drawn. "Drop the gun," one officer shouted. Kit leaped at Homan, aiming to sink his teeth in him so Cushing could make the arrest. Instead, Homan fired 3 times, and Kit flew backward, landing on the ground. Cushing raised his weapon, fired at Homan, and thought he had hit him. Homan doubled over and started backing up, but continued firing at the officers who fired back at him. Cushing ran out of bullets. He tried to reload, but couldn't move his left arm. When he looked down, he knew why. It looked like his arm had been partially blown off. "I'm hit," he shouted before falling onto the ground next to Kit. Siebert unleashed a volley of shots from his rifle at Homan. Pop, 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 pop. The woods suddenly went quiet. Homan was mortally wounded, and Cushing was still lying on the ground, his left arm in searing pain. He recalled turning his head to side to find himself face to face with Kit, who stared at his best friend's eyes and watched his life drained out of them. Cushing feared he wasn't far behind. He thought of his young daughters. If he died, they wouldn't remember him. Then Siebert tied a tourniquet against round Cushing's arm. "He shot my dog," Cushing told him. "He's gone, Bill," Siebert said. Cushing heard the unmistakable sound of police gear clicking and clanking. Officers placed Cushing into a stretcher. As they carried him out of the woods and loaded him in an ambulance, Cushing saw an officer crying. The door slammed. Sirens blared and the driver sped toward the hospital. Staring at the ceiling, Cushing tried to focus. He thought of his daughters. "I'm still alive," he told himself. "I'm not going to die." 1 week later, after undergoing a handful of reconstructive surgery, Cushing went home with his left arm in a sling and a full police procession. When they pulled into the driveway, Cushing had to work up the nerve to enter his home. Everything was still there. Kit's bowl, the bed that still smelled like Kit, dog hair on the couch, everything but Kit himself. 10 days later, an officer drove Cushing to Cartwright Funeral Home in Braintree. Staff escorted Cushing into a viewing room where Kit's body lay in a coffin draped in an American flag. Cushing pulled up a chair and sat down, lowering his head onto Kit's body and wept. For one last time, it was just the two of them. Cushing thanked his partner for everything he had done for him, including taking those first bullets and burying the officer's precious extra seconds, and buying the officer's precious extra seconds that had saved Cushing's life. Then he wiped his tears. It was time for Kit's final send-off. Dozens of police from across the state watched as 6 canine officers, led by O'Reilly, placed the dog's casket in the back of a hearse. A procession of police vehicles slowly made its way to Gillette Stadium, where O'Reilly and other pallbearers carried Kit's casket onto the turf, which was painted with a large white message that read, "K9 Kit, end of watch, 6-4-21. As taps solemnly echoed across the stadium, officers removed the flag from Kit's casket, folded it into a tight, neat triangle, and presented it to Cushing. Then all the officers lined up and paid their respects to Kit. In the months that followed, Cushing began the long process of rehabbing his left arm, unable to do his job without full use of his limb. Instead of pouring his energy into Kit and police work, he opened a foundation in Kit's name. It provides canine teams with protective gear, including bulletproof vests for dogs, in hope of saving the life of his canine as brave as Kit. And there's a picture here of a statue of Kit standing alert at the police memorial. And they have a thing here of the different names of the different police officers who suffered and also Kit. Your true stories. Gotcha. We asked for it. What's the best prank you ever pulled? An exercise in futility. My best friend has always been competitive. Once while we used an adjacent ellipticals, I set mine to age 99 and 999 pounds. So the display show I was burning three times more calories than she was. She rode that machine like a bronco, trying to match me until I gave in and told her what I'd done. Now we both mess with the settings to amuse each other. The Dairy Queen's gesture. We live next to a Dairy Queen that naturally we frequent. My sister-in-law told us that we saved enough of the little red spoons that come with ice cream treats. We'd get a free blizzard. I saved and saved, but when I went to redeem my spoon collection, the cashier was confused. The manager broke it to me that there was no such promotion and gave me a free cone anyway. My sister-in-law couldn't believe I fell for it, and considering she's a notorious prankster, neither could I. Health nut glut. My aunt and uncle were religiously healthy eaters, so when they visited my medical officers on April Fool's Day, I knew a prank was in order. I forged a medical article extolling white bread, eggs, and red meat, warning of the dangers of whole grains and excessive vegetables. The longer they read, the lower they sank in their chairs, until they got to the last line. What can we conclude from this research? Never trust an article handed to you on April Fool's Day. I like that one. The old switcher flu. My new boyfriend and I had both scheduled flu shots. Mine was first, and before I got home, I moved the bandage from my arm to my derriere. He was distressed at the thought of receiving a shot there. When we returned for his shot, he was relieved when the pharmacist told him to roll up his sleeve instead. We both laughed hysterically on the way home. We've been together for 4 years now, so I guess he can take a joke. Getting an earful. A prankster in my office thought it would be funny to put a big glob of hand cream on the receiver of another co-worker's landline, so the goo would squish in his ear the next time he answered the phone. But the instigator didn't think it was so funny when he found out the hard way that someone had switched the phones when he wasn't looking. A light bulb moment. I stayed home while my parents went on vacation. Back at home, they dragged their luggage to the door and began turning on lights. Except the lights weren't working. My dad checked the breaker panel. No blown fuses. They checked her electrical bill. It was paid. Finally, my dad reached into a lamp to change the bulb. That's when they discovered all the bulbs in the house had been unscrewed just enough so they wouldn't work. Phoning it in. I work at a corporate IT department. One April Fool's Day, I forwarded phone calls for everyone in the entire office to one co-worker's line. Her phone blew up for hours with callers trying to find out why they couldn't reach their intended parties and asking when the situation would be fixed. It wasn't until the afternoon that she finally figured it out. Everyone else had a great day. Putting the gas in gaslighting. Years ago, all my boss could talk about was the fantastic gas mileage in his new Volkswagen Beetle. We got so tired of hearing about it that we decided to help by adding a gallon of gas to his car's tank every day. He was getting 260 miles to the gallon by the time he learned we had been up to. A prank for the books. If a lost library card turned up at the branch where I worked, the no-nonsense head librarian would get on the intercom and announce the owner's name so the person could come to the desk and retrieve the card. That gave me an idea. I made a bunch of fake library cards and scattered them around the stacks on April Fool's Day. All day, famous literary characters, Anna Karenina, Ramona Quimby, Sam Spade, and even Winnie Dapu were getting paged to come pick up their lost cards. When I returned to the library years later, the head librarian recognized me and said, "You're the one who did the April Fool's prank." Then I saw something I'd never seen in all my time working there. The head librarian smiled. Okay, this is a solicitation from Reader's Digest for something for Irrational Fears, but just some of the words in here are hilarious. Just because it doesn't make sense doesn't make it any less scary. Like getting sucked out of an airplane by way of the commode. You know it's not going to happen, but you can't help thinking about it every time you flush. Maybe you've got xerophobia, fear of dryness, please pass the chapstick, or hippopotamostrosesquipedaliophobia, fear of long words. Share your irrational fear and see the terms at rd.com fear, and your story might appear in future issues of Reader's Digest, unless you're too scared. About a couple of quotable quotes. The more you engage, the more you learn about different ways that people believe and worship. The more you can sit next to anyone and be a neighbor. Jennifer Gardner. The things that we experience when we're sitting at a table with people that we love are things that keep us alive. Dan Pelosi, a chef. It's important to know when to stop taking feedback to heart. There's more reward in taking a risk than listening to naysayers who don't understand the mission. That's with Misty Copeland, a ballerina. There's nothing wrong with being afraid of somebody. Just never be intimidated. Mike Tyson. I don't read for comfort. Comfort I source elsewhere. I read only to learn something and to be delighted by it. Richard Ford, an author. And now let's go to Consumer Reports. And as I mentioned last week, the Consumer Reports for this month is all about cars. So if you're not really interested, you could always gawk away from the program. But I think it's kind of interesting because even if you're not a driver, you have to ride in cars often, and I'm sure you are curious about what's going on in the market today. In addition, you know, your spouses or significant others also probably drive cars. The hot hybrid everyone's talking about. It's the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. It's called a PHEV, which runs on electric power for shorter drives but can switch to gas for longer trips, so you don't need to stop and recharge. And boy, does that make a lot of sense. If you are considering plugging into an electric vehicle revolution but worry about the potential hassles and uncertainty of charging on the road, a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, a PHEV for short, could be the right car for you. PHEVs bridge the gap between regular hybrid and an EV. Unlike a regular hybrid, which recharges its battery using only its gas engine and brakes, a PHEV can also be plugged in to add electric-only range, usually trained between 20 and 40 miles. It can charge overnight from a standard household outlet, so you don't need to purchase and install a special charger. Once the electric range is depleted, the gas engine provides power for longer trips. If you, like a majority of Americans, tend to drive less than 40 miles a day, you could end up visiting the gas pump just a few times a year. Figuring out if a PHEV is right for you might take more research up front than with a conventional gas car or hybrid. But for some drivers, it could save them money over a gas, hybrid, or electric vehicle, says Jake Fisher, Senior Director of CO's Auto Test Center. He says that in general, PHEVs can offer the best of both electrical and conventional cars for people who do most of the driving around town. But he points out that a conventional hybrid is usually a better choice for those who mainly take longer trips or don't have somewhere to plug in because they'll probably never make it up the higher purchase price of PHEV and fuel savings. There are currently more than 30 PHEV models for sale in the U.S., ranging from small hatchbacks to luxurious SUVs. Most are based on existing gas-only vehicles or hybrids. Last year, sale of PHEVs grew by 60%, a larger increase than for EVs or conventional hybrids. According to CR's analysis of vehicle sales numbers, over the past year, CR bought and tested some of the most popular PHEVs on the market. Here we explain how they work and tell you how to determine if a PHEV will save you money. We also highlight that PHEVs that Consumer Reports recommends that you choose the one that's best for you. Good news about PHEVs. Concern about charging logistics, such as where and when to charge, is the primary reason people are reluctant to purchase an electric vehicle. For many car buyers, PHEV provide most of the benefits for driving an EV without the worries about how and where to charge. In general, a PHEV costs less to purchase than an EV, is less pricey to fuel than gas or hybrid vehicles. Just how much you'll save on gas depends on how often you charge your PHEV. In most cases, the more you plug into PHEV, the more gas money and money you'll save, Fisher says. While fully charging a pure EV at a conventional 100-volt electric outlet can take several days, charging a PEV from a standard household outlet takes much less time. The models we tested took an average of 14 hours to charge at 120-volt outlet, but a level 2, 240-volt charger can top up the battery in less than just a few hours. Most PEVs don't work with public DC fast chargers. Though many lack the pin-to-your-seat acceleration of pure EV, most PEVs we tested are more satisfying to drive than the gas-only versions of the same vehicle. Our testing clearly indicates that a PHE version of any model is quicker and quieter than a gas-only version, says Globe Shinar, Associate Director of CR's Auto Test Center. Keep in mind that even with a full charge, PHEVs often engage the gas engine when it's cold outside, when extra power is needed for acceleration on steep hills, or just to keep gas from getting stale in the tank, says Alex Nizek, Manager of Auto Testing and Insight at CR. Well, what's right for you? If you don't have a garage or somewhere to plug in, or if you mostly drive long distances, a PHEV isn't the right choice for you. For example, when the Hyundai Tucson PHEV is driven with an empty battery, it gets 4 fewer miles per gallon or test than the hybrid version. If you never plug it in, a Tucson 8 PHEV can cost $150 more each year on gas than if you'd bought the conventional hybrid version. As with pure EVs, highway driving at temperatures below 40 degrees Fahrenheit can reduce a PHEV's electric driving range. Reliability can vary significantly among PHEV models. To check the CR reliability rating of any model before you buy, many of the least dependable PHEVs are from brands that struggle with reliability in general. By contrast, auto manufacturers that usually make reliable vehicles also tend to make trustworthy PHEVs. The most reliable automakers have proved it's possible to build a reliable PHEV like the Toyota's Prius Prime and RAV4 Prime, he says. General federal tax credits for leasing a PHEV can add to serious savings. For example, a well-equipped Hyundai Tucson SEL PHEV currently costs $30 per month less to lease than a base model Hyundai Tucson Hybrid Blue, even though the rest of the lease terms are similar. If you're trying to decide between an EV and a PHEV, fuel savings and tax credits could make leasing an EV the better choice from a financial standpoint, but you still have to charge it on the road. Four ways to power a car. Internal combustion engine, ICE, vehicles are conventional cars with gas or diesel-powered engines. Gas-only vehicles have higher overall emissions than comparable hybrids, PHEVs or EVs. Gas-only cars deliver their best fuel economy of cost and highway speeds. Hybrids, a pair of relatively small gasoline engines with an electric motor to provide greater fuel efficiency than most conventional cars that can't be plugged in. An electric motor supplements the gas engine and allows it to shut off at low speeds. Hybrids are more powerful than their gas-only equivalents. The battery for electric motor is charged as the engine and regenerative braking charging as well. Plug-in hybrids, PHEVs, generally have a large battery than regular hybrids. Unlike regular hybrids, they can travel solely on electric power at regular driving speeds, usually for 20 to 40 miles. PHEVs are designed to be plugged into charge. Once the battery runs out, the gas engine kicks in for a total range of hundreds of miles. Many PHEVs can charge overnight using a 120-volt outlet. Electric vehicles don't have conventional engines. They're powered by an electric motor that gets its energy from a large battery. They can usually travel over 200 miles between charges. The electric motor or motors has fewer moving parts and provides immediate acceleration that's much quicker than most conventional cars. A 240-volt EV charger is recommended for charging at home. Powerful public charging stations can replenish the battery far quicker, but it may be inconvenient to get depending on your location. Charging a depleted battery at home can be done overnight. The fastest public chargers can add 150 miles of range in about 30 minutes. The best PHEVs. These 10 PHEVs earned a CR recommendation after extensive testing. They scored well on a road test, often outshining the gas or hybrid versions of the same vehicle with quicker acceleration and quieter operation. In addition, their predicted reliability is average or above. The number one is the BMW X5 PHEV for $72,500. The sharp-handling X5 PHEV got a bigger battery for 2024, increasing its range and power. We'd recommend a 200-volt charger to refill the battery overnight. All-wheel drive is standard. Number two was the Kia Sportage PEV at $39,500 to $44,000, and is quieter and quicker than the regular Sportage. All-wheel drive is standard, and the interior is spacious. Number three is Hyundai Tucson PHEV for $38,500 to $45,000. Roomy and comfortable Tucson PHEV gets a generous 33 miles on electric power alone. All-wheel drive is standard. And the next one is the Kia Niro PHEV, PHEV for $35,000 to $40,000. The front-wheel drive Niro is available as a hybrid, PHEV, and pure EV. The Niro PHEV can go almost 500 miles on a single tank of gas and a full charge. And then there's the Mazda CX-90 PHEV for $50,000 to $58,000. The CX-90 PHEV has three rows of seating, a large cab, and a standard all-wheel drive. Handling is agile, although transitions from gas to electric power aren't the smoothest. And then there's the Ford Escape PHEV. The Agile Escape has a fairly quiet cabin. In our owner satisfaction survey, the Escape PHEV scored much higher than the gas and hybrid versions, but is available only in front-wheel drive. Also, the BMW 330e at $45,000 to $47,000. This PHEV boasts the same sporty handling and luxurious interior as already excellent 3 Series. All-wheel drive is optional. The battery takes up some trunk space. Also included is the Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV from $40,000 to $47,000. The 7-passenger Outlander PHEV is based on the Nissan Rogue and has a small third-row seat. It's quicker and quieter than the standard Outlander and has a higher city but lower highway miles per gallon. Oh, I should be listing what the mileage is. On the BMW, it's 39 EV, 375 plus in the gas. Gas-only mileage is 21 miles per gallon. The Kia Sportage was a range of 34 on the EV, 345 with gas, and an average is 31 miles per gallon. The Mazda has 25 miles on the EV, 430 miles on the gas, and it gets 23 miles per gallon. The Hyundai Tucson, at 33 at the EV rating, 345 on the gas, and my average is mile per gallon of 31. The Kia Niro has a 33 on the EV, 460 on the gas, and gets gas only at 47 miles per gallon. The BMW 330 gets 20 miles on the charge on the electric version, 300 on the gas, and it gets 28 miles per gallon on gas only. Ford Escape is the 37 range on the electric mileage, 405 on the gas, and gets 30 miles per gallon. The Mitsubishi Outlander gets 38 miles per gallon, 365 on the gas. Gas only is 25 miles per gallon. The Toyota RV4 Prime trades for $44,000 to $48,000. It gets 42 miles on the EV charge, 500 on the gas, and gets 34 miles per gallon. The already recommended RAV4 is quicker and quieter as a PHEV thanks to a combined 302 horsepower from its electric drive and its 2.5-liter four-cylinder engine. And then there's Toyota Prius Prime. Goes for $33,000 to $40,000. Range of miles is 39 on EV, 455 gas, and gas only is 43 miles per gallon. The Prius Prime has a larger battery than the regular Prius Hybrid. Unlike the regular Prius, it's front-wheel drive only. Its long electric range is based on the trim level. PHEVs with the worst miles per gallon. Hybrid doesn't always mean great miles per gallon. Adding electric-only range helps automakers sell few thirsty luxury cars and heavy off-roaders while still meeting emission standards in the U.S. and globally. The pricey BMW XM has a lightning-quick acceleration. The Jeep Wrangler 4XE can silently tackle a trail on electric power. And the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4XE is more efficient than the gas-only version. But all three have some of the shortest electric ranges and the lowest combined gas-only EPA fuel economy estimates among PHEVs. Now, the BMW X1 only goes for $159,000. I'll take two or three of those. Gas-only miles per gallon is 14. Electric range is only 31 miles. The Jeep Wrangler goes for $51,000. Gas only is miles per gallon is 20, electric range is 25 miles. And the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4E goes for $61,000. It gets 23 miles per gallon gas only and only has a 21 mile per gallon EV. Now, here's a big question. Will a PHEV save you money? We've calculated the cost of owning a 3CR-recommended PHEVs, compared them with their gas, hybrid, or EV counterparts. A PHEV will almost always cost less the fuel than a conventional car, and will usually cost less than a hybrid, too, says Jake Fisher, Senior Director of CR's Auto Test Center. But on average, the purchase prices of PHEVs we tested were 50% higher than their gas-only counterparts and 33% higher than the hybrids. Whether your fuel savings will cover the additional purchase cost depends on a number of factors. We calculated for drivers who put 40 miles a day on their cars, plugged in their EVs and PHEVs nightly, and take 400 or 500 mile road trips each year. We assumed a blend of city and highway driving and optimal temperatures for electric range, used the latest fuel and energy prices available in January 2024, and chose the electric, gas and electric prices for states with energy costs that represent most of the country. PHEVs give you the flexibility to pick whichever energy source costs less, Fisher says. But if you live somewhere with high gas prices and relatively low electricity costs, such as Washington State, we found that a PHEV will save you more money per mile than if you live somewhere with lower gas prices and higher electric rates, such as Massachusetts. The savings are less significant in states such as California, where electricity and fuel costs are high for both, and Florida, where both costs are relatively low. And fuel and energy prices for states in their comparison. The regular per gallon in California was $4.70, for Massachusetts it's $3.12, for Florida it's $3.09, for Washington it's $4.11. For premium gas, it's $5.07 in California, $4.19 in Massachusetts, $3.82 in Florida, and $4.57 a gallon in Washington. Electricity, on the other hand, in California is 27 cents a kilowatt. Massachusetts is 28 cents a kilowatt. Florida is only 15 cents a kilowatt, and Washington State is only 11 cents. Okay, let's look at the three PHEVs. First of all is the BMW 3 Series. The xDrive PHEV scored an 81 at $60,000 as tested. The 3D xDrive with gas is $52,000 as tested. The winner in this case is the PHEV. In general, PHEVs will save you money in fuel over gas-only version of the same vehicle as long as you regularly plug it in. The payback period depends on your fuel and energy costs. The BMW 330 PHEV costs $1,390 more than the conventional 330i. With a modest electric-only range of 20 miles, the 330e pays itself in just under 3 years in Washington, but over 7 years in California. How about the Hyundai Tucson, which scored an 82 for the PHEV and an 85 for the hybrid? The PHEV is $39,000. The Tucson hybrid is $36,000. By and large, a PHEV will cost more to purchase than a conventional hybrid. In the case of this Tucson, any fuel savings might not make up the $3,395 difference in cost, especially if electricity is expensive where you live. But conventional hybrids aren't eligible for a federal tax credit of up to $7,500 that may help defray the cost of leasing a PHEV. And then there's the Kia Niro. The PHEV scored an 85 and cost $36,000. The EV, code of 71, cost $42,000. Fueling costs are similar between the two vehicle types, and the EVs almost always cost more upfront to purchase than PHEVs. The Niro EV would make a financial sense only if you could take advantage of state and local incentives that apply to EVs and not PHEVs. If the manufacturer is offering a lease deal on an EV, or if you have solar panels at home. How about the brands that make the best cars? We rank automakers from the best to the worst on their scores and survey results. How we rank the car brands. The overall score for individual models is based on four key factors: CR's road test, reliability, owner satisfaction, and safety. For the road test score, we put vehicles through more than 50 tests. Predicted reliability ratings are based on problems reported by members from 20 possible trouble areas in CR's annual auto surveys. Owner satisfaction predictions are based on whether CR members said in our surveys that they buy the same vehicle again or given the chance. Safety includes an assessment of any available crash test results and extra points assigned to vehicles that came standard with key crash preventive medicines. Okay, what is the best overall car? BMW, scored 82, which is 2 points above the next two highest. That is Subaru and Porsche. Honda, Lexus, and Mini scored 78s. The Kia, the Mazda, and the Toyota all scored 77. The Hyundai scored a 76. The Acura, 73. An Audi, 72. A Buick, 69. A Cadillac, 68. And a Genesis, 68. The Infiniti scored a 67. Ford scored 65. Telsa, 65. Nissan, 64, as did Mitsubishi. Lincoln scored a 63, while Chevrolet and Volvos and Chrysler all scored 62s, and Dodge scored a 61. And then we drop into the yellow ratings. Volkswagen, Maserati, Alfa Romeo, Mercedes-Benz, Rivian, GMC, Jaguar, Land Rover, and Jeep all scored in the 50s or 40s. Our annual ratings of 34 automakers could steer you in the right direction when making a new car purchase. These rankings are based on the average overall score, a combination of our road test scores, predictive reliability, and owner satisfaction data of all the model automakers. Here's some info we all need. What the heck is a mild hybrid? Some new car lingo to know. Scratching your head over the acronyms and techie auto terms in this issue? Here's your crib sheet. ICE, I-C-E. Pronounce it the way you do the word that means frozen water. It stands for internal combustion engine, and basically it means your car uses gas or diesel fuel. A mild hybrid. These offer some electric assist to run an ICE's electrical accessories, but they don't compare with regular hybrids in terms of fuel efficiency. Audi, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and Volvo make these, and no, they won't save you very much on fuel. A turbocharger. Makes a small, energy-efficient engine more powerful and fun by force-feeding air into the engine's cylinders. Picture Popeye eating spinach with a leaf blower. That's great. PHEV. If you don't know what a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle PHEV is, you drove right past the big feature on the immense issue. Maybe you always read the last page first. These can be charged. This, by the way, this is the last page. Can be charged with a regular electrical outlet, and some take you nearly 50 miles on that charge alone. After that, it switches to your gas tank, so no stuck-on-the-roadside charging worries. ACN, Automatic Crash Notification. Don't have your phone on hand when you're in a crash? Not surprising. The vital safety system automatically alerts first responders and tells them where you are. A heads-up display. Cool feature that protects speed and even navigation onto the windshield in front of the driver so that they do not need to look away from the road. DC fast charging. This isn't only for those driving around the nation's capital. It's just the quickest way to juice up your EV, about an hour versus 9+ hours using a typical home charger. Auto stop start. This fuel-saving feature shuts off the engine when the vehicle stops and restarts when the brake pedal is released. The switch that turns the system off may be more popular than the feature itself. All-wheel drive versus four-wheel drive. Nope, not the same thing. Both give you traction on all four wheels, but four-wheel drive is more slip-resistant, making it better if you're driving in muddy places. If you're mostly driving on pavement, all-wheel drive is a better choice. Well, we have a little time left, so let's do something totally different. Three little letters, 645 meetings. Imagine your dictionary editor for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, every week until the heat death of the universe or the day the human being stops speaking English, whichever comes first. It's your job to ensure that your trusted reference books keeps pace with the relentlessly evolving definitions of our seasonally expanding English language. No sweat, you think, picking up two boxes of citation for words beginning with the letter R. Where do I start? That's when you realize these boxes of citations, hundreds of scraps of paper showing each word in every possible context, are all for a single word, a three-letter word, the most complicated, multifaceted word in the English language. You might think it's absurd, and maybe it is, but Oxford English Dictionary editors recently revealed that run, R-U-N, has indeed become the single word with the most potential meanings in all of English, boasting no fewer than 645 different usage cases of the verb form alone. The copious definitions of run, featured in the OED's upcoming third edition, begin with the obvious. To go to, with quick steps on alternate feet. Then proceed to run on for 75 columns of type. This entry in all its girth took one professional lexicographer 9 months of research to complete. Wonder how often it took them in the most annoying words in English. But how could three-letter words be responsible for so much meaning? Context is everything. Think about it. When you run a fever, for example, those three letters have a very different meaning than when you run a bath to treat it, or when your bathwater subsequently runs over and drenches your cotton bath runner, forcing you to run out to the store to buy a new one. There you run up a bill of $85 because a rug and some cold medicine. You also need some thread to fix the run in your stockings and some tissues for your runny nose and a carton of milk because you run through your supply at home. And all this makes dread run through your soul because your Value Club membership runs out at the end of the month and you've already run over your budget on last week's grocery run when you ran over the nail in the parking lot and now your car won't even run properly because whatever idiot runs Walmart apparently lets its custodial staff run amok and you know you're letting your inner monologue run on and on, but gosh, you'd do things differently if you ran the world. And breathe. And maybe you should run for office while you're at it. It bears mentioning that run didn't always have the run of the dictionary. When OED's first edition came out in 1928, after 70 years of editorial research, the longest entry belonged to another three-letter juggernaut, SET. Even today, the print edition of OED contains some 200 meanings for SET, beginning with put, lay, or stand, something, in a specific place or position, and continuing on for about 32 pages. So what happened? Why is run suddenly the Swiss Army knife of verbs? British author Simon Winchester fancies it a feature of our more energetic and frantic times, making words like set seem almost stodgy by comparison. Run appears to have earned some major lift during the boom of the Industrial Revolution, when all manner of mechanized innovation adopted it as their verb of choice. Machines run, clocks run, computers run. Therefore, all those meanings which begin in the middle of the 19th century. So ready to run through the whole list of definitions? Alas, read all 645 meetings, you'll have to wait for the next edition of the Oxford English Dictionary that is expected to run in 2037. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to the next time and don't run away. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading and not running for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening. And don't run away too fast.